to 1 Kings chapter 19 is where we're going to start tonight, looking at the what we can learn from the life of Elisha. We looked at Elijah on Sunday morning, and now getting to Elisha. True or false, Elijah and Elisha were related to each other? No, they weren't related to each other. I guess sometimes we put the names together like they're brothers, like Cain and Abel and Isaac and Esau and Elijah and Elisha, but they're not related. Their names sound alike, but that's just a coincidence. Jeroboam and Rehoboam, not related. Yes, sir?
Were they both Jews?
They were both Jews.
They were related.
Okay, so they were related. Thanks for clarifying that. Not close. They probably met somewhere back at Noah, maybe. What do we know about Elisha? What do you know about him? Say again. He was bald. The first thing that's said about Elisha, the thing that stands out is that he's bald. Okay. He asked for and received a double portion of what Elijah had. What else do you know about him? Elisha. He was the successor to Elijah. Anything else? He was a what? He was a prophet. Very good. Not a prophet who wrote, but a prophet who spoke and worked for God. Look at 1 Kings chapter 19. And this is just a real quick look at how we are introduced to Elisha in 1 Kings chapter 19. We're introduced to him because God told Elisha to go and to anoint him and to make him the one that would take his place, that would follow him. Did Elisha say, you got plans for me? You know, am I on the way out? Am I about ready to kick the bucket? You know, what's the deal? I'm supposed to appoint my successor. Am I done? No, he goes and he chooses Elisha. But here's what we learn about Elisha in verse 19. 1 Kings 19, 19. Elisha departed. He found Elisha plowing in the field. He's a farmer. His family were farmers. He was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen. How many is that? That's 12. Okay. How many oxen is that? I'll ask it better. 24 oxen. How do you control 24 oxen? That's pretty impressive. I mean, I didn't grow up on a farm, so, you know, plowing with two oxen would be impressive to me. But plowing with 12 oxen, or 12 yoke of oxen, Elijah passed by, threw his mantle on him. What's Elijah doing carrying his fireplace with him? Thanks, Joe. What's a mantle? Well, he had some kind of a cloak that he had on. Why did he throw it on him? Symbolic? Symbolic that he was the one that had been chosen. What did Elisha do? Elisha said, please, verse 20, let me kiss my father and my mother and then I will follow you. I don't know. It sounds like some of the excuses that Jesus got, doesn't it? But Elisha was a family man. He loved his family. He goes back, and it's interesting in verse 21 that he takes a yoke of oxen, takes two of these oxen, slaughters them, boils them, and then gives them to the people and they ate. He wanted to go back and take care of his family before he took off. Guy who's concerned about others. And then he goes and he commits himself and he follows Elijah and becomes his servant. You know, if you had a successful business, and I would guess that if you're plowing a field with 24 oxen, that you're pretty successful in what you're doing, you're going to give that up to become a servant? Why would you do that? Why would you give all of that up? Turn your back, leave your family, leave your success, and go and become a servant. Was he a servant of Elijah? Yes. Greater than that, he was what?
Servant of God.
So he goes and he follows, and this is our introduction to Elisha. And Elijah and Elisha work for a period of time together so that Elisha can kind of, I guess, learn how things go. But from what we know, Elisha worked for the Lord as a prophet for about 60 years. You know, we pick him up here in 1 Kings 19. We read about him through about 2 Kings 7, 8, and 9. He's mentioned again in chapter 13 when he dies. But, you know, we have it in just about 12, 13, 14 chapters. And yet, there's so much that he did, and we only have a glimpse of it. It's hard to talk about Elisha without talking about Elijah. You know, the two just go hand in hand. I want to look at just a couple of the similarities about Elijah and Elisha. What was Elijah's last miracle? Look in 2 Kings chapter 2. What was Elijah's last miracle? You know what it was? Before he took the chariot ride into heaven, what was his last miracle? Parted the waters of what? Parted what waters? Jordan River. Did you know that Elijah parted the river, the waters of the Jordan? When else were the waters of the Jordan parted? Joshua, when they came in to conquer the promised land. How does Elijah part the waters this time? Did he have the Ark of the Covenant and the guy stepped in the water and it parted? It's the mantle again. Carrying it. So he takes the mantle, strikes the water, it parts. What was Elisha's first miracle? Verse 14. Same thing. How are you going to get back across the water? Well, I saw Elijah do this. I'll try it. Last miracle of Elijah was the first miracle, same miracle that Elisha did. The language that they used. You know, we don't have a lot of words from these prophets. We have more from Elisha than we do from Elijah. We really don't have a lot of things said by Elijah. But the words that they used to the kings are very similar. Look at just one of them in 2 Kings, since you're already there, chapter 3 and verse 14. This is similar to what Elijah said to Ahab, where he begins by saying, "As the Lord of hosts lives, before whom I stand." If you start a sentence with that, what does that mean? What does that show? As the Lord of hosts lives, does God live? Has he always lived? Is he always going to live? Before whom I stand, as God lives and I'm standing right here in front of him, what I'm about ready to say to you has nothing to do with me and all to do with God. That's the way that Elijah spoke. That's the way that Elisha spoke. It ought to be the way that we speak. You know, it's not about me. But God lives and I'm standing before him. And here's the message that I need to tell you. Similarity number three, they were both cared for by widows. Remember when there was a drought in Israel and Elijah came to a widow's house after the ravens and the brook had been feeding him, and he comes to the widow's house, and we looked at this on Sunday. She had enough meal and enough oil to make one more meal for her and her son, and then they were going to die. And we looked at the story last week, how God, through Elijah, perform that miracle so that her oil and her flour never ran out. But we have similar stories about Elisha. Look in chapter 4. We talked just briefly last on Sunday about the fact that this widow that helped Elijah, that her son died and that Elijah raised him from the dead. We've got the same thing in 2 Kings chapter 4. There's this in fact, and we'll see this as we get into this, in 2 Kings chapter 4, Elisha wanted to do something nice for this widow. And so he told her, where is it, like verse 14, 15, and 16, that she's going to have a son. Well, she said in verse 16, "Don't lie to me. No, you're going to have a son." But then the son dies, and you get down in verse 32, there was the child lying on the bed dead. He went in, therefore, and he shut the door behind the two of them, and he prayed to the Lord. He went up and lay on the child, put his mouth on his mouth, his eyes on his eyes, his hands on his hands. He stretched himself out on the child, and the flesh of the child became warm. He returned and walked back and forth in the house, and again went up and stretched himself out on him. And the child sneezed 7 times, and the child opened his eyes. The detail of this. He called Gehazi and said, "Call this Shunammite woman." So he called her, and when she came up to him, he said, "Pick up your son." She went in, fell at his feet, bowed to the ground. She picked up her son and went out. Here's Elijah and Elisha. Is God concerned about widows? We've got two of the premier prophets of the Old Testament interacting and caring for widows who are in return being cared for by widows. And here are two men that raised the sons of these widows. Similarity number four. The first prophecy, miracle that Elijah was a part of was that drought that lasted for 3.5 years. Well, that had to do with no rain and no dew for 3.5 years. And Elisha's first public miracle, the parting of the Jordan was just him probably. His first public miracle is when he goes and heals the water. So again, the similarities between the two of them are more than just in their name, but a lot has to do with their actions. But what about some contrasts? Are there any differences between these two guys? Elijah was like John the Baptist in the wilderness, out by himself, kind of dwelt out, not among the people so much as Elisha did. Elisha was there in the valley. He had a family. He was among a people, seems to be, more than Elijah was. Elijah kind of appeared and disappeared on the scene fairly often. You see him when he prophesies to Ahab, and then he kind of disappears for a while, and then he appears back before Ahab, and then he's gone. And it's, when he ran off to the cave and he was concerned that he was the only one. And so Elijah was kind of spotty. That's not a criticism. That's just how we read about him. But Elisha seemed to be much more among the people. He seemed to be accessible. When Naaman had the leprosy, did they know how to find Elisha? They knew where the prophet was. He was known by the people and known where he was. Elijah seemed to be kind of a prophet of fire. You think about the fire coming down on that altar. You think about him going up in a chariot of fire. You think about all the various things that happened in the lifetime of Elijah that had to do with fire. But he was kind of a fire and brimstone kind of preacher. Elisha, while he carried that through, his message and his work seemed to be one more of mercy and of compassion towards the people. And then that kind of carried over to their miracles. And this isn't the whole of it because there are exceptions, but Elijah's miracles seemed to be more about death and destruction, and more of Elisha's miracles, of course he performed more, were more about healing and restoring people's health. And then one more contrast, and I'm skipping through some of this because I want to get to some more stuff where we can just sit and look at this. Elisha could be called a statesman. If he worked for 60 years, he had a pretty significant relationship with several of these kings. And when the kings needed a message from God, they knew where to go. And when they needed to be healed, they knew where to go. They knew that Elisha was aware of their conditions. In fact, let me see if I can find this real quick. I think it's in chapter 6. Go to 2 Kings chapter 6. I hope this is where it is. 2 Kings chapter 6 and verse 8. And when we talk about the kings that he had a relationship and kind of a statesman, these weren't just the kings of Israel and Judah. Here's the king of Syria in verse 8. 2 Kings 6 and verse 8. The king of Syria was making war against Israel. He consulted with his servant, saying, "My camp will be in such and such a place." So that's what he told his servants. He didn't tell anybody else. He just told his servants, "Here's where my camp is going to be. I'm going to put my camp over here." Do you want your enemy to know where your camp is? No. So this is for your ears only. My camp's going to be in such and such a place. "And the man of God sent to the king of Israel, saying, 'Beware that you do not pass to this place, for the Syrians are coming down there.'" Huh? How did he know that? "Then the king of Israel sent someone to the place of which the man of God had told him. Thus he warned him, and he was watchful there, not just once or twice. Therefore the heart of the king of Syria was greatly troubled by this thing, and he called his servants and said to them, 'Will you not show me which of us is for the king of Israel? Which one of you big mouths is out telling people where we've got our camp?' One of his servants said, "None, my lord, O king." But Elisha the prophet, who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom. How does Elisha know what the king of Syria is saying in his bedroom? I mean, sometimes you think people know what you're saying in your bedroom, right? And you're like, you know, get out of here. God allowed Elisha to know these things. Obviously, that's miraculous. But at the same time, here was a man who was known by the king of Syria and by the king of Israel. And sometimes the kings didn't really know what they needed to do about Elisha. Because sometimes he was very straight with them and telling them about their doom and what was coming upon them. But here's what I think is interesting. Go to 2 Kings chapter 2. I've got 1 Kings 19 up here, but we've already looked at that. Go to 2 Kings chapter 2. What I think is interesting is the close relationship that Elijah and Elisha had with each other. It was not just a working relationship. It was not just a, well, Elijah, go and get Elisha, and he's going to be your successor, so you kind of show him the ropes and teach him how to do things. They had a very close relationship with each other. 1 Kings chapter 19 says that Elisha became Elijah's servant. But look in 2 Kings chapter 2. Came to pass, verse 1. Came to pass when the Lord was about to take up Elijah into heaven by a whirlwind, that Elijah went with Elisha, there they are together, from Gilgal. Then Elijah said to Elisha, why would he say this? They're on the road. Elijah said to Elisha, "Stay here, please, for the Lord has sent me unto Bethel." But Elisha said, "As the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, I will not leave you." So they went down to Bethel.
What verse was that?
That's verse 2. 2 Kings 2, 2. Elisha, you stay here. I don't know why Elijah was telling Elisha to stay. Elisha knew that the end was coming. Why would he be telling Elijah, "You stay here and I've got to go over here"? Is it possible that he was testing him? Is it possible, you know, to see, well, you know, let's see how serious Elisha is about taking my place and becoming my successor? I don't know. There may be some kind of a test in there to test his loyalty, to maybe test his patience. But Elisha says, as long as you live, I'm sticking with you. Look in verse 4. There at Bethel, Elijah said to Elisha, "Stay here, please, for the Lord has sent me to Jericho." But Elisha said, "As the Lord lives and as your soul lives, I will not leave you." So they came to Jericho. Same thing, same statement from Elijah. You're like, sorry about my abbreviations. I had to get everything to fit on here. But here's what Elijah says to Elisha three times. Stay here, please. Go to verse 8. Verse 6, I mean. Elijah said to Elisha, "Stay here, please, for the Lord has sent me on to the Jordan." But Elisha said, "As the Lord lives and as your soul lives, I will not leave you." So the two of them went on. Why three times? By the way, three times. Look in verse 3. The sons of the prophet said to Elijah, "Do you know that the Lord will take away your master from over you today?" And Elisha basically said, "Keep your mouth shut. Be quiet." Verse 5. Sons of the prophet said to Elisha, "Do you know that the Lord will take away your master from over you today?" Shut up. Same thing. Why is all of this happening repeatedly? The Bible doesn't tell us things. The Bible doesn't put details in there just for fun. How many times did Jesus ask Peter, "Do you love me?" Three times. Why? Wasn't one time sufficient? Click, click, click. I think I got it now. "Stay here, please, while I go over there." "No, I'm going with you." Okay. He passed the first test. "Stay here, please. I've got to go over there." "No, I'm going with you." third time. I don't know if these were tests, but it appears to be. And Elisha passed with flying colors. Say, no, I am not going to leave you. They get to the Jordan. And is it verse 7 that says that there were the 50 sons of the prophets? And they went, stood facing them at a distance. But there's the two of them in verse 7. Just the two of them. Notice how close they are. They're continuing to be together. Who stood by the Jordan? Elijah, verse 8, took his mantle, rolled it up, struck the water, divided it this way and that. So the two of them, not anybody else, just the two of them crossed over the Jordan. Verse 9, so it was when they had crossed over that Elijah said to Elisha, ask, what may I do for you before I am taken away from you? Elisha said, please let a double portion of your spirit be upon me. Why would he ask that? Was he greedy? Oh, I've seen what you can do. I want to do twice as much. Is he greedy? Selfish? No, I think Elisha is saying, you know what? For me, I'm going to have twice as much just to do what you were able to do. Twice as much. Was that something that Elijah was able to give to him? It's conditional. Look in verse 10. Elijah said in verse 10, you have asked a hard thing. Nevertheless, if you see me when I am taken from you, it shall be so for you. But if not, it shall not be so. You think Elisha was going to keep his eyes on Elijah for the rest of that day until he was taken? I think I'm going to keep my eyes on you. Here's something interesting, and I don't know if this has anything to do with it. Go back to Deuteronomy. Where is this? Deuteronomy chapter... Oh, where is it? It's in the 20s. So just get to Deuteronomy 20-something. I got to find the page. Thought it was in Deuteronomy 21, but I'm not seeing it. Go to Deuteronomy 21. It's got to be there. Yep, there it is. Deuteronomy 21. Oh, of course, I've got it in the slide. I could have just looked at it. Deuteronomy 21, verse 7. Deuteronomy 21, verse 17. Just don't be so picky, you know. 7:17, it's all there. Deuteronomy 21:17. But he shall acknowledge the son of the unloved wife as the firstborn by giving this son a double portion of all that he has. For he, this son, the firstborn, is the beginning of his strength. The right of the firstborn is his. I don't know if this has anything to do with why Elisha asked for a double portion from Elijah, but the law in Deuteronomy was that the father was to give unto the firstborn double portion. Now, come back to 2 Kings chapter 2. Elijah says, I don't know that I can do that, but that's going to be up to God. So then verse 11, 2 Kings chapter 2 verse 11, it happened as they continued on, the two of them, and talked, that suddenly a chariot of fire appeared with horses of fire and separated the two of them. And Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. And Elisha saw it and he cried out, what? My father, my father, the chariot of Israel and its horsemen. I don't know if Deuteronomy 21 has anything to do with this, but what kind of relationship did Elisha think that he had with Elijah? Very close. He felt like he was a son, felt like Elijah was his father. But he recognized the greatness of Elijah and said, I'm going to need about twice as much to be able to do what you have been able to do. So he sees him go up. When he says, my father, the chariot of Israel. What is the chariot of Israel talking about? Is he talking about the chariot that he's riding in? Or is he talking about Elijah being the chariot of Israel? I mean, is the fiery chariot, is that the chariot of Israel? Well, it's a representation, I guess, of God taking Elijah back to heaven. So God could be called the chariot of Israel. But could Elijah be called the chariot of Israel? Who had been trying to keep Israel on the right path? Who had been speaking to these wicked kings and telling them that their judgment day was coming? Who was it who said to Israel, how long are you going to falter between these two opinions? Choose a God and serve him. Elijah was a very significant character in the Old Testament. Elisha knew that. So he took hold of his clothes in verse 12, tore them in two pieces, and he took up the mantle of Elijah that had fallen and took it with him in order that he might become what God wanted him to become. I don't know how much time we've got, but here's one of the greatest things about Elisha, are the miracles that he performed. Some have looked at the double portion aspect of this. Give me a double portion, and they look at the number of miracles that Elijah performed, the number of miracles that Elisha performed, and said, well, it's double, so that's how he got double. Well, I think Elisha performed more than double the number of miracles that Elijah did. I think there's more recorded, more than double recorded. So you could look at it from that aspect. The portion that Elisha was looking for was not just the ability to perform miracles. Elijah, he had the strength, he had the fortitude, he had the willingness to go before wicked kings and tell them like it is. You think that would be easy? Can you show me, and please understand that I'm not trying to get political here or say anything about our current president. We could say this about any president, okay? Can you point to the person in our nation right now who would be willing to walk up to the president, point to him, and say, you are doing wrong and you need to start doing right? Because the path you're going is going to take you someplace you don't want to go. And to point at them and to tell them, like Elijah and Elisha did, to tell them like it is. Again, I'm not talking about, I'm not specifying, but I'm saying, who in our nation right now would be willing to do that? We got a bunch of chickens in our nation, don't we? That's the way who's willing to stand up and to say to someone in power, who's willing to go to Iran's guy? His name just flew out of my head. Not that I can spell it or pronounce it anyway. But who would be willing to go before I need a job or whatever his name is? It rhymes with that. I just can't remember what it is. You all know what I'm talking about. Who would be willing to go point him in the face and say, you're wrong. You're wrong in saying these things. You're wrong in doing these things. You need to turn around and do right. Who'd be willing to do that? What's going to happen to the person that does that to Benijab or whatever his name? What's going to happen to him? You're done. Consider your life over with. You know, if you get thrown in jail over there just for hiking where you're not supposed to be hiking, guess what's going to happen to you if you stick your finger in his face? Okay, back to Elijah and Elisha. Is it going to take some determination to do that? Did Elijah stand down? Was he fearful of doing that with Ahab? When Ahab said to Elijah in 1 Kings chapter 18, is that you, O troubler of Israel? The king's throwing it at Elijah. Is that you, O troubler? What did Elijah do? Oh yeah, it's me. It's me again. No, he picked it up and threw it right back at him. No, you're the one who's troubling Israel. We don't need to be ones who will be ashamed of speaking where we need to speak. Now, let's look at these miracles real quick. What do we got? 6 minutes. That's not enough time. 2 Kings chapter 2. We already saw that he divided the Jordan River with Elijah's mantle that was now his mantle. And then he gets across the Jordan River, and it's kind of like the children of Israel and Moses. They did a lot of complaining about water, didn't they? Go figure. Here's the next prophet in line, and what are they complaining about? They're complaining about the water. 2 Kings chapter 2, the water is bad in verse 19. It's just bad. And so what does he do? Bring me a bowl of salt, throws the salt in the water. There, it's healed. It's good. A miracle that he cleans up the water. Now, here's what Tina was thinking about. This is her favorite story in all the Bible. When he's walking down in 2 Kings chapter 2, went he went up from there to Bethel, verse 23, and as he was going up going up the road, some youths, those silly little kids, came from the city and mocked him. How many were there? There were 42 of these youths. And said, "Go up, you bald head, go up, you bald head." What happened? Did he turn around and say, "Now, kids, that's not nice"? He turned around and looked at them and pronounced a curse on them. Now, some of us would put a period there. That we announced a curse on them. Yeah, all right, some people would do that, right? With some curses in there. "Oh, you're going to call me a bald head, you little..." You know, right back at them. No. Announced a curse on them in the name of the Lord. Now, come on. These are just kids, right? They're just youths. Cut them a little slack, right? They don't know any better. Just Elisha, let them go. You know, get over the fact that you don't have any hair. Be a big boy about it. Why do we have this story? Why do we have a story about two she-bears, two female bears? Interesting that we know that they're two female bears who come and maul and kill these 42 kids. Why do we have that story? Do we need to have respect for our elders, for those who are older? Do we need to have respect? What was Elisha? He was the prophet of God. Do we need to have respect for those who carry the Word of God, for those who are older than we are? Do we need to teach this story to our children? You know how many times I've taught this to my girls? And not just because I'm losing hair, but because they need to know to respect authority. And this is a great place to learn it. If you ever get out to Glacier National Park and you get up in the mountains and you see the grizzly bears, great time to teach your children. All right? This object lesson about what these two she-bears did in 2 Kings chapter 2. All right, jump from that. 2 Kings chapter 3. Cool story. Man, I wish we had more time with this. Cool story that they don't, again, they're in need of water. They don't have water down in the valley. And Elisha comes and says, "Oh, you're going to get water. There's going to come some canals that start coming through this valley." Well, if it would just start raining, you would get some natural canals, right? So that wouldn't be miraculous. No, 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 no. No wind, no rain. These canals, this water is just going to show up. And the next day, it did. Chapter 4. Similar story as Elijah, except now here's a widow. And her sons in 2 Kings chapter 4, is that the right place? 2 Kings chapter 4, the creditors in chapter 4 verse 1, they were coming to take her two sons to be slaves. She says to Elisha, "We got to do something about this. They're coming to take my sons to be slaves." So he says, "Okay, how many vessels do you have in your house?" "Okay, go get some more. Go get more vessels." And her son went to get the vessel and brought it in, and she kept pouring the oil into the vessel. Where's she getting all this oil? Same place the widow from Zarephath got all the oil that she needed. God kept filling up that pot. She kept filling them up, and she got all the vessels that she could. She had all of these pots and pans and vessels full of oil. Then what did Elisha say to do with them? "Go sell them. Take the money, pay off the creditor, your sons are freed." God looked at this widow, and God was concerned for this widow and took an opportunity to care for her. This great woman of Shunem that we've already talked about had a son that was promised to her by Elisha. He died, and Elisha raised him from the dead. Chapter 4, another incident with food, where there's a pot of stew that apparently is bad. At least they said verse 40. Is it verse 40? "Boil the stew, sons of the prophets." They did not know. Verse 40, "Man of God, there is death in the pot." Now, that doesn't mean that you go home and you start complaining about the food in the house and say, "There is death in the pot," unless you are able to throw some flour in it, verse 41, and make it not harmful. Because I believe that if you probably went home and said there's death in the pot, that if there wasn't, there would be. But he throws flour in the pot. Would that do about the same thing as throwing salt into bad water? Well, for us it would. Why did God have Elisha throw salt into bad water and flour into a bad pot of stew? What good is it going to do? Oh, in the hand of God, it's going to take care of it. And then we've got a lot of similarities. We noticed, I think, one already with Jesus. But at the end of chapter 4 is another one where he had 20 loaves of barley bread in verse 42, newly ripened grain. And he says, how in the world are we going to feed 100 men with this? And he says, we've got enough. And they took up leftovers, just like they did in the story of Jesus. I think probably the most familiar story to us in the life of Elisha is his healing of Naaman. I think that's probably, if you start looking at this list, for Tina, it's the bears and the youth. I'm sorry, Tina. But you're never going to come to my class again, are you? And then there's Naaman, who's probably the most familiar. Here is this mighty man of war who's brought down because of his leprosy. A man who is the captain of the Syrian army, who can do anything, take anything, destroy anything, except he can't take care of his leprosy. He's in charge. He's at the very top. He's the head. And of all the things he can do, he can't take care of this leprosy problem. Can you imagine being that powerful and it's a little girl who tells you where the answer is? How would you react? Oh, just shut up and go play your iPod already, would you? You know, was that first? The second bell. How can that be the second bell? Anyway, so what happens? You go and dip 7 times in the Jordan River. Dip 7 times. Was Naaman cleansed? He didn't think that was going to work, did he? No more than salt or flour or dipping in. Those things don't work. Oh, yes, they do. That is the power of God. The power of God works in all of these. And I wanted to get to that floating axe head because I think that's a cool story. But read chapter 6 about that. If you don't know about the floating axe head in chapter 6, that's a really cool story. Here's Elisha, man of God, prophet of God. Successor to Elijah, but he was not second class by any means. Took up the torch that Elisha was carrying for the very purpose of trying to get people to turn back to God and to follow him. Sorry we ran out of time. Thank you all for your participation and attention tonight.